Suddenly, and stopped. An eerie glow was enveloping it now, faint and golden. It was indeed a hairless bear, though the head was round, the ears and nose humanoid. The beast's eyes were large and slitted like a great cat. Malevolence shone in the creature's golden gaze as it stood, blinking in the strange light. "Gillar!" shouted the man in red, beginning to run across the ice. "Gillar!" The noise caused the creature to jerk its head. It blinked, then focused again on Tsigane. Thin lips drew back to expose a set of sharp teeth. Long arms came up, talons gleaming in the moonlight.
"Step aside, Garl,"
came a calm voice. Tsigane scrambled back. The glowing figure of Ironhand was standing before the creature now, a two-handed sword held ready. He was translucent and shimmering, and Tsigane could not believe such an insubstantial figure could hold back the power of the beast. As the creature growled and leapt, the golden-lit sword flashed out, cleaving through the huge chest. There was no blood and no visible wound, but the demon tottered back and then sank into the ice. The red-garbed wizard looked horror-struck as the last of the beasts fell. Ironhand swung to him.
"It has been a long time, Jakuta," he said.
"You can't hurt me. You might be able to slay a demon soul, but you cannot harm the living."
"Indeed, I cannot, nor will I have to. Is this not the third time you have tried to steal Sigarni's soul? And where is your familiar?"
The wizard blanched. Slowly he drew a wickedly curved dagger.
"There is still time," he said. "She cannot stand against me."
"There is no time, Jakuta,"
Ironhand told him.
"I can see them now."
The wizard spun. Heavy footprints were thumping down in the snow, scores of them. Dropping his knife, the wizard began to run. Tsigane saw him make fewer than 20 paces before his body was lifted into the air. His arms and legs were torn from him, and his screams were awful to hear. They were cut off abruptly as his head rolled to the ice.
"You should have called upon me,"
Ironhand told the stunned woman.
"I needed to fight them alone," she said.
"I would expect no less from Ironhand's daughter,"
he told her. Just as the dawn light crept over the mountains, a tiny pocket of darkness opened like a black teardrop on the hillside overlooking the frozen falls. Taliesin stepped from it, leading a blindfolded Ballistar. As his feet touched the snow-covered earth, Ballistar collapsed to the ground, trembling. Tearing loose the blindfold, he blinked in the light. Taliesin gave a dry chuckle.
"I told you the way would not be to your liking,"
he said.
"Sweet heaven," whispered the dwarf. "What kind of beasts made the noises I heard?" "You do not wish to know," said Taliesin. "Now let us find Tsigane, for I am already growing cold."
"Wait," ordered the dwarf, pushing himself to his feet and brushing snow from his leggings.
"What now?" "There are traps set," Ballister told him. "She did not come here to hide, she came to fight. Now give me a moment to gather my wits and I will lead you to her."
"There may be no need," said Taliesin softly, pointing to the ice-covered pool.
Ballister saw the patches of blood smeared across the ice. He and Taliesin moved carefully down the slope. The dwarf spotted what appeared to be two boulders close to the center of the pools.
"Atrolls," said Taliesin. "Creatures of the first pet."
A severed human leg was half buried in the snow. Taliesin tugged it clear. The boot was still in place.
"Not hers,"
said the wizard.
"That is promising."
Ballistar backed away from the grisly find and stepped on a human hand.
"Dear God, what happened here?"
he said.
"Aha!"
hissed Taliesin, finding the head of Jakuta Khan. Lifting it by the ears,
He brought it up until he could look into the grey corpse face.
Well, well, he said. Come to me, Jakuta.
The corpse eyes flipped open and blinked twice. The mouth began to move, but there were no sounds.
No good trying to speak, my boy, said Taliesin with a cruel smile. You have no throat. I take it I called you back from your torment. It must be so very terrible. Are they still hunting you? Of course they are.
Ballistar saw tears form in the sunken eyes.
Well, I can help you there, Jakuta. Would you prefer your spirit to live for a while in this hapless skull, free from terror? You would?
Gently, he laid the head upon the ice, then spoke in a harsh tongue unknown to Ballistar. The ice around the severed head began to melt away. Taliesin knelt by it.
As long as there is still flesh upon the skull, you will be safe here, Jakuta. But when the fishes have stripped it away, you will return to the pit.
The ice gave, the head falling into the cold water beneath as Taliesin stood.
How was it still alive?
Asked Ballistar.
I called him back. I fear his stay will be brief. That was terribly cruel.
Taliesin laughed.
Cruel? You have no idea what he suffered where he was. He called upon the creatures of the pit for help and failed them. Now he dwells with them in perpetual torment. I have given him a short respite from that. At the bottom of an ice lake? How kind you are, sneered Ballistar. I never cling to be kind. I am certainly not disposed towards mercy for such as he. Jakuta Khan caused the death of Iron Hand and destroyed a dynasty that might have changed the course of our history. He did it for profit, for greed. Now he pays. You want me to grieve for him, dwarf?
Ballistar nodded.
Yes, that would be good. For in what way are you different from him, Taliesin? You delight in his suffering and you add to his torment. Is that not evil?
Taliesin's eyes narrowed.
Who are you, dwarf, to lecture me? I have fought evil for 10 times your lifetime. Even now in my own land, the ancestors of these outlanders are waging a war that will see hundreds, perhaps thousands, of my people die. What pity I have is for them, and there is nothing that I would not do to save them. Now find me the woman.
Ballistar swung away from him and walked back across the ice. With care, he climbed the slope before the cave, feeling his way forward.
For the sake of heaven, hissed Taliesin. Why the delay? I am freezing to death out here.
Ballistar ignored him. Some way to the left he halted, his hands burrowing into the snow.
What now?
Asked Taliesin, exasperated. There was a sharp hiss, then a sapling reared upright, whiplashing back and forth. 3 sharpened stakes were bound to it.
It is a peg spear trap, said Ballistar, but angled to strike high. The twine is connected to a ring at the end of the tripwire. Yes, yes, I need no instruction. Are there more? We will see, said Ballistar.
The cave was no more than 40 feet away, yet it took the 2 men almost 30 minutes to reach it. Taliesin was the first inside, where Sigarni was sleeping by a dying fire. The wizard sat down beside her. Satisfied that she was alive, Ballistar walked away.
Where are you going? There may be more traps. I don't want some unsuspecting traveler to spring one.
Outside, the dwarf took several deep breaths. His relief was almost palpable. Sigarni was alive. Ballistar stood for a moment scanning the area. To the right, he could see a huge grey corpse, 2 arrows in its chest and 3 stakes in its back. 1 trap. On the hillside there was another body. Ballistar trudged out towards it. For 2 hours he searched the land around the pool. There were no more traps. Returning to the cave, he found Sigarni still asleep, with the wizard dozing beside her. Taliesin awoke as he entered. Four creatures were killed, said the dwarf, squatting by the fire and extending his hands to the heat. One had a dagger in its heart, one was slain by a pig spear trap, the third by a lance arrow. There was no mark on the fourth.
She did well, agreed the sorcerer. How did she pierce their skin? Asked Balistar. I could not pull her dagger free. It was as if it was embedded in stone.
It was, said Taliesin.
You have seen the corpses of men stiffen in death.
Balistar nodded.
With the Aatrolls, it is many times as powerful. The corpses turn grey like rocks, that within a few days they putrefy and disappear. Even the bones rot. Will more come? It is unlikely, though not impossible. Jakuta pursued Sigarni through the gateway of time. He had to, for his soul was pledged against her death. I know of no other sorcerer hunting her.
Why did he seek her?
Perhaps she will tell you that when she wakes, said Taliesin. Now I am tired. I shall sleep. Be so kind as to fetch wood and keep the fire blazing.
Sigarni stood on the battlements, staring out over the flanks of the mountains and the distant peak of Hydruin. Ironhand stood beside her, his huge hand on her shoulder. Moonlight glistened on his braided silver beard and shone from his silver chainmail and breastplate. She felt power radiating from him, encompassing her, bathing her in its warmth. "Where are we?" she asked.
"You mean you don't recognize it?"
he said, mystified.
"I'm sure that I've created it perfectly. Perhaps you need to see it from the outside."
"I know this area," she told him. "There's nothing here save a few wooded hills."
"It cannot be,"
he said, his hand of red iron sweeping out to encompass the hills.
"This is my stronghold of Aldruin. It was here that I fought the four armies and slew their champion, Greil."
Sigarni saw the sadness in his eyes. "I'm sorry, Ironhand. I have travelled these hills all my life. There are some broken stones that show there was once a large dwelling place here, but it is long gone, and not even the eldest of the Loda know what stood here."
"Ah, well,"
he said, turning from the parapet.
"It was merely stone, and at least you can see it now. Come inside and we will talk. I have a fire prepared. It will offer no heat, but is pretty to look upon."
The scene shimmered, and Sigarni found herself in a rectangular room, velvet curtains covering the high windows. A log fire blazed in the hearth, but as Ironhand predicted, it burned without heat. "How is it done?" she asked, running her hand through the flames.
"Here, all is illusion. We are spirits, you and I."
The giant warrior, clad now in a simple tunic of green, with soft leather trews, sat himself down in a deep chair. Sigarni seated herself on the bearskin rug before the fire.
"It took a long time to learn how to do all this,"
he said, waving his hand to encompass the room.
"I do not know how long, for there is no sense of the passage of time. To me it was an eternity. Now it is the only home I know, save for the pool by the falls where my body lies."
Sigarni sat silently, aware that his sorrow was great.
"Iron Hands Falls. It is a beautiful place,"
he continued, forcing a smile.
"A man could choose far worse for his death. During the centuries I have watched the trees grow and die in that wondrous cycle of birth, growth, and death. People, too. Hunters, wanderers, tinkers, clansmen, foreign soldiers. And I saw you, Sigarni, diving from the edge of the falls, straight as an arrow. I was there when you found my bones, but I could not speak, for you were not ready to listen. You can have no idea how good it is to speak to another soul."
"Are there no others here?" she asked.
"No, not now. This is my world, the silent kingdom of Ironhand. Others have come, demons and evil spirits. I slew them, and now the others avoid my lands.
You must be lonely. He nodded.
I hope you will never know how much. I would give anything, except the darkness and solitude of the true grave, for just 1 hour in your mother's company. It is not yet to be. I can accept that.
My mother? Asked Sigani. You knew her.
Did you not listen to me back at the pool? You are my daughter, Sigarni. Your mother was my wife, Elorane. I see her in you. The same strength of purpose, the same pride.
But you lived hundreds and hundreds of years ago. I can't be your daughter. It's not possible. I knew my mother and father, lived with them until they were slain.
For all my faults, Sigarni, I was never a liar. Not in life and certainly not in death. You were born in the last year of my life, when enemies I thought were friends were meeting in secret with plans to destroy me. When I did learn of their plans, I urged Elorin to run to cross the water. She would not.
He smiled at the memory.
We will fight them, she said. We will conquer once more. I tried. My wizards were slain, all mystic protection lost to me. That was the work of Jakuta Khan. I tried to reach Elorin, but the assassins trapped me at the falls. I died there. Elorin died at Kashar. I learned this from Taliesin when he summoned my spirit to the falls. You were a babe then. He and Caswallon carried you through a gateway and left you with your new parents, a fine couple. Unable to have children of their own. Taliesin disguised you, changing the color of your hair.
Reaching out, he stroked her head.
All our family are born with silver hair. We took it as a sign of greatness. Perhaps that was arrogance. Perhaps not. We did become kings, after all, and not one foreign enemy ever brought us low.
How? Did my mother die? Asked Sigarni. Did Taliesin tell you this?
Aye, he told me. She had a saber in her hand, the blood of the enemy staining it, and as she died she cursed them.
He rose and turned away from her, a tall man of immense power and even stronger grief. His head was bowed and Sigarni went to him, taking his hand in hers. Why are you here? Asked Sigarni tenderly. Why not in paradise, or wherever it is that heroes go? He smiled.
I had to wait, Sigarni. I made a promise, a sacred oath, that I would come again when my people needed me. I have felt the desire to quit this place many times, seeing the far light shining, but I will not travel the swan's path until the time is right.
Perhaps she waits for you there, Elorin.
I have thought of that often, but I never made a promise I did not fight to keep. Now that promise is upon me, for you are the heir to Ironhand. You are the hope of the Highlands.
But how can you help me? She asked. You are a spirit, a ghost. What can you do within the world of men?
Nothing.
He admitted.
But you can, and I shall continue to teach you what it means to be a king. I will recreate battles for you, and you shall see how they are fought and won. I will show you my life, the traitors and the friends, the good and the deceitful, the brave and the unmanly. All of this and more you will experience here.
How long will this take?
As before, you could be with me for what seems like years. Yet when you awake, only a single night will have passed. Trust me, my daughter. When you return, you will be closer to the warrior queen they have longed for.
I forgot much of what passed between us before. In the true world, all this will seem a hazy dream.
The knowledge will be there, he said, as it was at Kilfallon.
That was your doing, Ironhand shook his head and led her back to the fire.
Not at all. It was you. What I did was to open your mind to the ways of war. I never lost a battle, Sigourney, for when forced to fight, I was always prepared with lines of retreat and secondary plans, and I understood the importance of speed, of thought, of action. You have a fast mind and great courage. You will teach your enemies to fear you.
We have a very small army, said Sigourney. The enemy is large, well-disciplined, and used to the ways of war.
Aye, it was the same with me at the very beginning. There is, however, an advantage in such a situation. An army is like a man. It needs a head and a heart, two good arms, two sound legs. It requires a strong belly and a solid backbone. Now, while it is yet small, is the time to lay the foundations of your force.
Which is the leader? Asked Sigourney. The head or the heart? He chuckled.
Neither. He, or in this case she, must be the soul.
Take heed, my daughter.
Choose your men with great care, for some will be exceptional when commanding small forces, less capable with larger groups. Others will seem too cautious, yet when the swords are drawn will fight like devils.
And how do I know which to choose?
Honor your instincts, and never cease to be vigilant. You can read a general by the attitudes of his men. They may fear him or love him. That is generally of no consequence. Look at their discipline. See how fast or how badly they react. The men are merely an extension of the captain commanding them.
How then does the soul operate?
The head suggests the plans. The heart gives men spirit. The backbone gives them strength. The belly gives them confidence. The soul gives them the cause to fight for. Men will fight well for loot and plunder, for pride and honor, but when the cause is perceived as noble, they will fight like demigods.
Sigourney sighed. All this I can understand, but when the war starts, I cannot keep traveling to the falls to speak with you, to ask your advice. I will be alone then, and my lack of experience could condemn us all.
I cannot be with you always, Sigourney, for this is your world and your time. When the spring comes, dive once more into the pool and swim to where my bones rest. Take one small fragment and keep it with you. Then you may call upon me and I will be with you. Let no one know of this, and never speak to me unless you are alone. Now, let us begin with your lessons.
Fel was tired, his spirits low as he stood in the new long hut, watching Sigourney discussing tactics and strategies with Asmodeer, Obrin, Tovey and Graeme. The Paladese man Lauren was present, sitting quietly, offering nothing but listening intently. Beside him was the colossal Merith. Gwyn Darkeye, Bacchus Toothgone, and other group leaders were also seated on the floor before Sigourney, who occupied the only chair. In all, there were close to 40 people present. It seemed to Fel that the meeting was drifting aimlessly, yet Sigourney seemed unperturbed. Some were for storming the three outland forts, others for sending raiding parties into the lowlands. Voice after voice was raised in the debate, often resulting in petty arguments. Fel soon became oblivious to it all, allowing the sound to wash over him. Tired, he sat with his back to the wall, resting his head against the wood. The late summer seemed so far away now, when he had travelled to Sigourney's cabin to have his wound stitched. Her beauty had dazzled him, and left a heaviness in his heart that would not ease. She was so different now, tense as a bowstring, her eyes cold and distant. She no longer laughed, and gone was the lightness of heart and the carefree joy she once exhibited. Now, she kept a distance from her followers, allowing no man to come close. A week before, Fel had been explaining some of the logistical problems to her, and had touched her arm. Sigourney had drawn back as if stung. She had said nothing, but had moved further away from him. Though hurt by it, Fel saw that he was not the only man to affect Sigarni in the same way. No one could approach within touching distance of her, save the dwarf. He would sit at her feet, as he was doing now. Fel rubbed his bloodshot eyes. Food was running low. There had not been enough salt to preserve all the meat, and much of it was now bad. The only cattle left were breeding stock, and to kill these would cause great grief among the clan and ensure future famine. It had been bad enough slaughtering all the others. Grown men had wept at the loss. All cattlemen understood the need of the winter cull, for there was not enough fodder gathered to feed all the animals through this hardest of seasons. But to lose all the hay meant the destruction of whole herds, the loss of prize bulls which were the result of generations of breeding. The period of late winter was always a time of hardship, when the milk cows dried and the meat was all but gone. This year would be 10 times worse, and it would be followed by a terrible war. Fel drifted into a troubled sleep, only to be awoken by the sounds of men pushing themselves to their feet. Cold air touched him as the doors were pushed open, and the forester struggled to his feet, dizzy and disoriented. Lauren, Asmodeer, Obrin, Tovey and Graham all remained behind, as did Ballistar. Fel decided to leave them to it and move to the door, but Sigarni called him back.
"I need some sleep," he said.
"You can sleep later," she told him, then turned to the others. Fel walked to where they all sat and joined them. Sigarni stood.
"Obrin has now appointed 25 group leaders," she said. "It is therefore time for our warriors to know the structure of our leadership. There will be 2 wings in the army. Graham will lead one, and Fel the other. Obrin will retain responsibility for training, and will also captain a third and smaller force. The role of this third force I will discuss with you later. Tovey, you will relinquish the role of Hunt Lord, passing it to me. From that moment you will remain in charge of all supplies, the gathering of food, and its distribution. You will liaise with Lauren. Later you'll have a second role, and that we will discuss tomorrow."
Fel glanced at the former baker, and saw that his face had grown pale. Tovey had worked as hard as any during and after the exodus from Lodelands. To lose his role as Hunt Lord was bitterly hard, and would be seen as a humiliation. No one spoke. All waited for Tovey's reaction. The man pushed himself to his feet and walked slowly from the building. As the door closed, Fel spoke.
"That was not right," he said. "It was called cruelty, and the man deserved more than that."
"Deserve?" countered Sigarni. "Did his son deserve to die? Do the Loda deserve to be living in the mountains as beggars, their homes destroyed? Did I deserve—"
Abruptly, Sigarni returned to her seat, and Fel could see her struggling to control her anger.
"The decision is made," she said at last. "The left and right wings of the army will be led by you and Graham. Obrin will select your groups tomorrow. Discuss the dispositions with him. Once your wings are organized, you will work with him, testing your officers and, if necessary, promoting others."
"Does Asmodeer have no role?" asked Fel. "I understood he was once a general."
"He will advise me. Now the hour is late, and as you said, Fel, you are in need of sleep. We will meet here tomorrow night, and then I will tell you of Obrin's force and what they must do."
The men rose to their feet and walked from the room, leaving only Obrin with Sigarni. Fel stepped into the moonlight, Graham beside him. The white-bearded smith clapped him on the shoulder.
"Do not be so downhearted, General," he said. "If Tovey is honest, he will admit to his relief. His heart is not in war. It would have been more kind had you spoken to him alone."
The smith nodded. "She's been through the fire, boy, and it does tend to burn away softness. And she'll need to be harder yet if the Loda are to survive."
"Those words should be chiseled in stone," said Asmodeer softly from behind them.
The two clansmen said nothing. Neither was comfortable in the presence of the black man. He smiled and shook his head, then politely bade them good night and headed for his own small hut. "I don't like that man," said Graham.
He can be trusted,
said Ballistar, from where he was standing unnoticed by the door.
I'd stake my life on it. I didn't say he couldn't be trusted, little man. I just don't like him. There's no heart in him.
Snow began to fall once more, and the bitter wind came down from the north. Fell pulled his cloak around his shoulders.
I'm for sleep, he said. I feel like I haven't closed my eyes since autumn.
I'll stay up for a while yet, said Graham. She gave us much to think about. He grinned at Ballistar.
I still have a jug of Gwalchmai's throat burner. You're welcome to a dram.
Ballistar chuckled.
Just the one, mind.
Fell left them and wandered away.
Oberyn's anger was hard to contain as he stood before Sigarni. If you want me to die, why not just ask one of your soldiers to do it, or you could cut my throat now.
I am not looking for you to die, Outlander.
The coldness of her tone only served to inflame him further. Oberyn forced a laugh.
Come now, lady. There's no one else here. I see the way you look at me, loathing and hatred. You think I've never seen it before? What I don't understand is why you'd want to send 100 of your own men to die with me.
Are you finished? Stormed Sigarni, rising from her chair. Or have you still some whining to do?
She stood directly before him, her eyes blazing.
You are entirely correct in your assessment of my feelings towards you. Perhaps towards all men, including clansmen. There is no room in my heart for love, no room. In less than 12 weeks an army will descend on these mountains, and I must have a force to oppose them. Not only that, but they must be denied supplies. They have 3 forts built deep into our territory.
Tell me what they contain.
You know the answer. Tell me, exactly.
Food and supplies, weapons, bows, arrows, lances, swords, helms. But more importantly, they each contain 100 fighting men and are impregnable against all but a huge encircling force. The palisade walls are 25 feet high, the entrance guarded by drop gates. Any force approaching would be open to bowshot for 100 paces all around the fort. Once they arrived, they would have to scale the walls. I've done that, lady, and I can tell you that a man with a good sword can kill 20 men scaling. You can't defend yourself when you're scrambling up a rope.
I am not asking you to scramble up ropes, Oberyn. I did not ask you to assault the fort on Farland land. I said you were to take it. Now will you listen to my plan?
I'm listening, he said, but I spent half my life building those damn forts. I know what goes into their construction.
I want you to ride up to the drop gate with your 100 men, and I want you to relieve the defenders of their command.
Oberyn's jaw dropped.
Relieve? What are you talking about? When we were both at Asmodeir's home, I asked you about the forts. You said the men who manned them would expect to serve no more than 2 months, then a relief force would arrive. But the snow, there's no way through those southern passes.
They won't know that, will they?
You are a former officer, sergeant, he corrected.
Whatever, she snapped.
Some of them may know you, and that is good.
They've been trapped in those forts and will have no knowledge of your change of loyalty. We still have the weapons, and what passed for uniforms of the mercenaries who attacked Kil Fallon. We also have the horses. I want you to choose 100 men and take over the Farland fort.
He said nothing for a moment, his mind racing. They would be hoping for a relief force. Most of the men would be thinking about the midwinter celebrations in Citadel. The parties, the dancing, the women.
It's a fine idea, he said. But I should be carrying sealed orders from the Baron. Without them, no officer will turn over his command.
Sigarni returned to her seat, and he could see her pondering his words.
Discipline, she said softly. Orders and rules.
She nodded. Tell me this, Oberyn. What would happen if a verbal order reached a commander, and when refusing to obey it, the Baron's plans were thrown into chaos? Would the Baron merely congratulate the commander on holding to the rules?
It is not quite that easy, replied Oberyn,
In that situation, the Baron would have the man flogged or hanged for not acting on his own initiative. But if the commander did obey the verbal order and then failed, he would still be blamed for not holding fast to the regulations.
I see, said Sigani. Then you will ride to the Farallon Fort with only, say, 85 men. Get some bandages soaked in cattle blood and disguise some of your men as wounded. You will ride to the fort and tell the commander that your officer was slain and that you are the relief force. You will say that the Paladin's fort is under attack and that the Baron has ordered the commander to reinforce it.
But there are no sealed orders.
You will tell him that when you were surrounded, your officer, thinking all was lost, destroyed the orders so that the enemy would not see them. Then a blizzard broke, and you were able to lead your men to safety.
You won't relinquish the fort, said Oberyn stubbornly. You have to understand the officer mentality.
Oh, I think I understand it, Oberyn. Hear me out. The commander will be caught on twin horns. If he disobeys an order you tell him was issued by the Baron and the Paladin's fort falls, he will be hanged or flogged. If he obeys and everything goes wrong, he will be asked why he did not follow the rules and remain where he was.
Exactly, said Oberyn. Then, as a good sergeant, you will help him. You will offer to lead the rescue of the Paladin's fort. That way he has not disobeyed an order, and he has not left his post.
Aye, said Oberyn slowly. He might go for such a plan.
But where does that leave us? I'll be riding out again with my men.
No, his men. You will explain that your forces are exhausted, whereas his are fresh.
So I ride out with 100 enemy soldiers behind me. What then?
You lead them into an ambush. Graham will tell you where.
Oberyn stared hard at the tall young woman. Her face, though beautiful, was emotionless. The eyes cold now and cruel.
You are a canny woman, Sigani, he said. It has a good chance of success.
Make it succeed, she urged him. I need those supplies and weapons. More importantly, I need to deny them to the Baron.
I can understand that, lady, but why that fort? The Paladin's is closer. Even if we do take the Farallon Fort, we have a great distance to cover carrying the supplies back here, much of it over rough country.
You will take all 3 forts, she assured him.
The Farallon will be first, and you will not carry the supplies far, only to Torgon's town. Then you will move on to the others.
Now get some rest, and be here tomorrow at dawn with Graham and Tovey.
Oberyn bowed and walked out into the night. He could hear the sounds of laughter from Graham's hut, but elsewhere all was quiet. She was canny, all right. Not only would the plan, if it succeeded, ease the food shortage and rob the Baron of his spring supplies, but it would also impress the Farallon, who had lost scores of men in useless assaults on the fortification. And the chances of success, he knew, were high indeed. Sigani was using the enemy's great strength against them.
Discipline. Blind obedience.
Who would have thought that an untutored clanswoman could have such a devious mind?
All women have devious minds, he said aloud. That's why I never wed.
Sigani rapped on the door of the small hut.
Who's there?
Called Tovey. Stepping inside, she saw the hunt lord sitting by an open fire. He glanced up as she entered.
How did you find me?
He asked. Coleraine has a talent for these matters. Why are you not with your family?
I need time to think.
Sigani sat down opposite the man. You are angry.
What do you expect? I know I was a better baker than a hunt lord, but I have done my best since the attack. I could do no more.
I did not ask for more, said Sigani. I need your skills in other areas.
What skills?
He asked bitterly.
You want me to bake bread for you? I can do that. Just build me an oven.
Yes, I want bread, she said softly. I want the people fed.
Battles alone will not win us the war, Tovey. Once we have defeated the First Outland Army, we will need to move from defense to attack, and that means invading the lowlands. The army will need to be supplied with food. We will need mercenaries, and that means we must have gold, a treasury. Our forces will be spread, and that requires lines of communication. You understand? The role I need you for will stretch your talents to the limit. You will have no time for other burdens.
Why could you not say this in front of the others? Why did I need to suffer humiliation, Sigourney?
She looked at the older man, saw the hurt in his eyes.
They did not need to know my plans. There are hard days coming, Tovey. Some of the men in that room will die in our cause. They may even be captured and tortured. Worse, one or more of them will seek to betray us. What I say to you here is not to be repeated.
I may be captured and tortured,
he pointed out. It is unlikely, for you will not be fighting.
You deny me even that, a chance for revenge to restore the honor of my family.
Listen to me. What is more important, that you drive your claymore into one enemy heart, or your skills bring down 1,000? You are vital to me, Tovey. You have a feel for organization and a mind that can cope with a score of problems simultaneously. I have seen those talents here, in the four encampments. Few could have achieved what you have. When the war comes, I will need your skills.
He laughed and scratched his beard.
Here we sit with a tiny force made up of many old men and young lads, and you speak of invading the lowlands. Better still, I believe you when you speak of it. What has happened to you, Sigourney? From where do these ideas spring?
From my blood, Tovey.
All these years I have watched you, and never seen you. When you were a child, you used to hide behind my bakery, and wait until I stepped out the front for a breath of air. Fast as a hawk, you would sprint inside to steal a cake, just the one from the middle of the tray. Then you would push the others together, disguising the gap.
You knew?
I knew. You hid behind the water barrel.
How did you know?
Lemon mint. Gwalch, my always loved that scent. And you used to rub the leaves over your body when you bathed. Every time I stepped back inside, I could smell lemon mint.
You never caught me, she said softly. He shrugged.
I never wanted to. You were a child of sorrow, Sigourney. Everyone loved you. And I could spare a morsel on cake day.
Sigourney fed some wood to the fire, and they sat in companionable silence for a while. I am not that child any longer, she said.
I know. Yet she is still there, deep down inside. She will always be there.
He sighed and smiled.
I will serve you, Sigourney, in any way that you want me.
Thank you, Tovey, she said, her voice tender. For this, and for the cakes. Rising smoothly, she moved to the door.
Be at the log hall at dawn.
Why?
Because I need you there, she said.
Chapter 10 Torgon's mood was not enhanced by the news from his scouts that the Loder woman was riding towards the town. At first the people of the Farlan had talked of little else, how strong she was, how noble she looked, how brave. Torgon had fast become heartily sick of it. That was why he had led his rash raid on the Outlanders, to prove that he was the natural leader of the clans. It might have worked too, save for the craven tactics of the enemy, drawing back and then loosing cavalry upon him. Had they stood and fought like men, he was sure the Farlan warriors would have cut them to pieces. After that, he'd led 2 spectacularly unsuccessful attacks on their fort. Another 40 men had been struck by arrows. 7 had died. Now the Farlan were talking about Sigourney once more, how she had supposedly killed demons sent against her, and how successful she had been against the Outlanders at Kilfallon. God, could they not see what she was? Just a load of whore in pretty armour.
There was little doubt in Torgon's mind that the battle at Kilfallon had been masterminded by the black-skinned bastard who rode with her. Rode with her? Rhoda, more like. Now she was coming here again. This time, I'll make her humiliation complete, he thought. His wife, Laelia, entered the room bearing a cup of sweet tisane. He took it without a word and sipped it. Laelia did not depart, but stood staring at him. He looked up into her large, soft brown eyes. What? He asked gruffly. She is coming, said his wife. And all that, I'll deal with her. Are you sure you are in the right? What is that supposed to mean? He snapped. She flinched, which pleased him. A woman should know her place. I've heard talk that she is the chosen one. Karela told me... I'm not interested in women's gossip, Laelia, and I've heard enough. For a moment he thought she would stand her ground, but she bowed her head and left him alone once more. Torgon ran his hand over his close-cropped black hair. The bald spot was growing on the crown, and his widow's peak was becoming more pronounced by the day. He swore softly. Why should he alone if his family lose his hair? His father had a shock of white hair like a lion's mane until the day he died at 80. Torgon threw his cloak around his shoulders and stepped out into the winter sunlight. It was bright, the day clear and cold. He could see the Loda woman in the distance. The black man was not with her, but there were a dozen or so riders following her as she made her way down the long slope. More people were on the streets than was normal for this time of day. They were making their way to the square, ready to hear the whore's words. Torgon strode out, looking to neither left nor right. His chair had been set at the centre of the square. His lieutenants were already standing beside it. This time, there was no Neren or Kalias or Pimali. All had fallen in the battle. I never would have acted so fast had the woman not inflamed my anger, he thought. It is her fault they are dead. By the time Sigarni and her followers rode into the square, there were more than 200 Farlan gathered to witness the exchange. She did not dismount, but sat her horse, staring at Torgon. Well, woman, he called out, what now? Why are you here? Perhaps I just wanted to look at a fool, she said, her words colder than the wind. Perhaps I wondered whether the Outlanders had made you a general in return for the number of clansmen you killed for them. Torgon was outraged. How dare you! He shouted, surging to his feet. I did not come here to listen to your insults! Where do you normally go? She said. By God! I think you'd have to travel far from the Highlands not to hear insults. 300 men! You led them into a trap that a child could have seen. Or did no one mention cavalry to you? Did your scouts not see their biding places? Come to that, Torgon. Did you even send out scouts?
I don't answer to you.
That is where you are wrong, Sigarni told him, as dismounting she walked towards him. You answer to me, Torgon, because you have wasted 300 Highlanders, thrown their lives away in a moment of crass stupidity. Aye, you'll answer to me. Stepping in close, she slammed a right-hand punch to his chin. The blow shocked him and he stepped back, trying to ready himself. She turned away from him, then spun back and leapt, her boot cannoning against his jaw. Torgon hit the seat and fell heavily, striking his temple against the cold flagstones. Dazed, he heard her carry on speaking as if nothing had happened. Only she wasn't talking to him. She was addressing the Farlan. In 11 weeks, she said, an army will come to these highlands of ours, a murderous force intent on butchery. If we are to destroy them, we need to act together under a single leader. The fool lying there will lead you to destruction. I think you already know that. Pick him up. Torgon felt strong arms lifting him to his feet, then sitting him in his chair. The position of Hunt Lord can be passed from father to son, he heard her say. But that has not always been the Highland way. We are in a war. And it is up to you to choose a Hunt Lord who can best serve the needs of the people. All the people, Farlan, Loda, Palades, and Wingerath.
I do not care who you choose, but whoever it is will serve under my leadership.
By what right?
Asked the tall, broad-shouldered warrior with a silver moustache. Torgon blinked as Harkonnen stepped up to stand before the woman. His uncle would put her in her place. He was a man of iron principles, not one to be fooled by this whore in scarlet.
By what right? Echoed Sigarni. By right of blood and right of battle. By virtue of my sword and my skills.
He shook his head.
I do not know of your blood, Sigarni, but your battle was one skirmish fought at Kilfallen. As to your sword and your skills, I have seen no evidence that you can carry a fight with either. I say this with no disrespect, for I applaud your defense of Kilfallen and your determination to fight against the Outlanders, but I need more proof that you are the war leader we should follow.
Well said, she told him. And how would you like this proof delivered?
I cannot say, but one battle does not convince me. Even now the Outlanders are camped on our land, their position impregnable. A war leader should be able to free us of their presence.
What is your name?
I am Harkonnen.
I have heard of you, she said. You fought at Calden Moor. It is said you killed 20 Outlanders and led the king to safety.
He smiled grimly.
An exaggeration, Sigarni. But I was there the last time the clans gathered against the Outlanders, and I will be there the next time, God willing.
So then, Harkonnen, will you follow me?
I've already said that I need more proof.
Sigarni stood silently for a moment.
I will make a bargain with you, Harkonnen, she said at last. Pledge yourself to me, and then I will show you proof.
Why not the other way round?
He countered.
Because I require your faith as well as your sword.
He smiled.
I hear you require men to bend the knee to you, as if to a monarch. Is that what you are asking?
Aye, Harkonnen, exactly that, as in the old days. But you will not need to lead me to safety. You will live to see the Outlanders crushed and broken, begging for mercy. Now give me your pledge.
Torgon sat quietly waiting for the old warrior to laugh in her face. He did not. Instead, he walked slowly forward and dropped to one knee before her.
My sword and my life, he said.
Sigarni swung to the crowd. Throwing up her arm, she pointed to the line of horse-drawn wagons making their slow way over the crest of the hill.
Those wagons you see are loaded with the spoils of war, taken from the fort on Farland land. My forces took that fort 2 days ago. Even as we speak, the Palladies fort is falling to us.
Harkonnen rose. How many men did you lose?
He asked.
None, she told him. Assemble the council, for I would address them.
Harkonnen bowed, and Sigarni turned to Torgon.
I could, and probably should, kill you, she said. But you are a Highlander, and not without courage. Be at the council meeting.
Torgon rose and stumbled away, his mind reeling.
Gwalchmai was sober. It was not an uplifting experience.
As he sat in the log hall, surrounded by the younger children of the encampment, he found himself yearning for the sanctuary of the jug. There were several older women present dishing out the last of the milk to the eager young, and about a dozen younger mothers sitting in a group, holding their babies and talking animatedly. Gwalchmai could not hear their conversation, for most of the smaller children had gathered around him and were asking questions he found it hard to answer. For some weeks now, his powers had been waning, and he found himself unable to summon visions. It was ironic that now of all times his talent should desert him. He had often prayed to be released from the gift, the curse, and now that it had happened, he felt terribly alone and very frightened. The clan needed him, and he had nothing more to give.
Why do they want to kill us all, Gwalchmai?
asked a bright-eyed young boy of around 12.
Have we done something wrong?
No, nothing wrong,
he grunted, feeling himself hemmed in by the youngsters.
Then why are we being punished?
It's no good asking me to make sense of it, lad. It's a war. There's no sense in war.
Then why are we doing it?
Questioned another boy.
We don't have a choice,
said Gwalchmai. There was still a little left in the jug, he remembered. But where had he put it?
Are we all going to be killed?
Asked a girl with long red hair. Gwalchmai cleared his throat. A man's voice cut in, and Gwalchmai looked up to see Colorin moving through the youngsters. The younger man grinned at Gwalch, patted his shoulder, and then sat down beside him.
When a thief enters your house,
he told the children,
to take what is yours, and you either allow him to roam unchecked, or you stop him. When a wolf pack attacks your cattle, you slay the wolves. That is the way of the hunter. The outlanders have decided to take all that is yours. Your fathers have decided to stop them.
My father is a great hunter,
declared the girl.
Last year, he killed a rogue bear. Not on his own, said the boy. My father was with him. He shot it too. He did not.
A squabble broke out between the two. Colorin's laughter boomed out.
Come, come, clansmen, this is no way to behave. I did not have a father. Well, not that I recall. I had a mother who could shoot a bow or wield a sword. Once, when a lioness got in amongst our sheep, she strode out to the pasture, carrying only a long staff, and frightened it away. She was a fine woman.
You are an outlander, said the first boy,
his earnest gaze fixed to Colorin's face.
Why do you want to kill us?
I never wanted to kill anyone,
Colorin told him.
There are many outlanders, as you call them, from many nations. They have built an empire. I am from one part of that empire. They conquered my country 110 years ago. The outlanders are not by nature evil. They do not eat babies or make blood sacrifices to vile gods. Their problem is that they believe in their own destiny as masters of the world. They respect strength and courage above all else. Therefore, the strongest and most ruthless tend to achieve high rank. The Baron is such a man. He is evil. And because he leads in the north, his evil spreads through the men under his command.
What happened to your father?
Asked the red-haired girl.
He ran away when I was a babe.
Why?
Colorin shrugged.
I cannot answer for him. My mother told me he found life on the farm too dull.
Did people torment you?
Asked a small boy with thick curly hair. Colorin nodded.
Ah, they did. A boy without a father becomes for some reason an object of scorn.
Me too, said the boy. My father ran away before I was born. He didn't run away,
put in another child scornfully.
Not even your mother could have said who he was.
The curly-haired boy reddened and started to rise. Colorin spoke swiftly.
Let us have no violence here. You are all of the clan, and the clan is in danger. It is no time to argue with another. But there is something else you could think about. How does evil grow? What makes it appear in a human heart, growing like a weed among the blooms? I tell you, it is born from anger and injustice, from resentment and jealousy. You have all witnessed the tiniest seed of it here in this hall. A boy, with no father, has been insulted for what may or may not have been the sin of his mother. That insult and others like it will simmer inside him as he grows. And by what right is he treated so unjustly?
Colorin fixed his eyes on the older boy.
Has his birth damaged you in some way?
Everyone knows his mother is a...
Do not say it,
said Colorin icily.
For when you speak thus, you give birth to evil.
It's the truth.
No, it is a perception of the truth. There is a difference. To the outlander, you are an untutored barbarian worth less than a pig. You are not even human. Your mother is a whore and your father is a stinking piece of filth who needs to be eradicated. That is their perspective.